The second of Digital Eclipse's Gold Master Series is out, looking at Jeff Minter of LlamaSoft. Plus, there's more fallout in the emulation scene after last week's shutdown of Yuzu. Tonight is March 17th, 2024, and the Bobby Blackwell Show, featuring your calls and chat comments, is up next. So you would say, even if... Okay, I'll let you go. You talk. Wow, what happened to your voice? Thank you, Skype. So video games, that's what the show is about.
This is that one Akia Ripper from Sweden.
And what's with all the Halo hate, Bob? You've been hating on Halo a lot lately.
I just don't like shooters. I'm not saying it's a bad game, I just don't like it. Billy O.K. says he can't be seen in public playing games that aren't hardcore. What would people say? And what up, G and Chad is once again talking about wrestling. That's why it's not because they hate the fans. It's more because they have to start from scratch.
Hogwash later.
From a little room in Atlanta, Georgia, Bobby Blackwolf.
Who is the patron saint of Hogwash? Because it's St. Hogwash Day, right? That's what pod culture says. Who is the patron saint of that? Hello, everybody, and welcome to a dark beer day, I guess, edition of the Bobby Blackwell Show, where we discuss the current news affecting the video game industry, as well as sometimes reminisce about gaming's history. My name is Bobby Blackwell. If you're joining us live here on St. Patrick's Day or, you know, White Pride Parade Day, whatever, you know, because there's all the parades going on of people celebrating their Irish heritage. Welcome. Thank you so much for being here. We do tape this show live just about each and every Sunday night, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, at the Voice of Geeks Network Twitch channel, twitch.tv/VogNetwork. Come join us. Interact with the show directly. But I also realize we are a podcast, so we do have a Discord server, vognetwork.com/discord. That is where you can talk back about episodes. We actually have a really long comment that was actually about stuff we talked about last week that it actually gives a little bit more perspective on things from somebody who actually knows a lot more about the emulation scene than I do. And so we really appreciate that because as much as I like being right, I'm not always 100% right. I'm just right most of the time. That's my story and I'm sticking to it. And I am here. I am not watching sports. I don't even have it on my phone. I'm not going to pay attention. I'm a season ticket holder to a local sports club, local football club, and there's a game tonight. My wife's there with a friend of ours, and they're hopefully having a good time. They were having a good time 10 minutes ago. I don't know since I started the show if they're still having a good time, but we'll see. I will say that I will not be here in 2 weeks, so we will have a show next week. I will not be here in 2 weeks. It's one of those things where, you know, I'm actually going to a concert. So it's, you know, it's one of those things like I don't always do this, but this is a band and the band's name is Dirty Loops and they're actually from Sweden. The last time they came through the U.S., I did not go see their concert and I regretted it for like 9 years because it was like 2014. So on the 31st, 2 weeks from now, I will actually be at that concert and I won't be here in 2 weeks, but I will be here next week. And so we'll just continue talking about stuff in the gaming industry, and obviously I'll still be on the Discord server and stuff and posting there. Let's talk about what we were talking about last week. So, emulation. I talked a lot about Nintendo settling with the developers of the Yuzu emulator for the tune of $2.4 million, and I was saying a lot of things about how, like, you know, well, we've already got settled case law that emulation is legal and, you know, things like that. And we actually have somebody in our Discord, it goes by 13X Forever, who's actually, like, really, like, embedded in the emulation scene. So knows way more about it than I ever would. And so I'm always thankful, you know, I always whenever I talk about emulation, I'm like, I don't want to say anything too wrong. Because I don't like being like, okay, well, you're off base here. So a little bit, there's a couple of things that 13X Forever wanted to highlight. Key points that most people get wrong, like me, or not consider, something I don't know. So we're going to talk a little bit more about Nintendo and going after emulators. So they say, Nintendo is being so aggressive in recent years, always hinged on their assertion that emulators are using keys and algorithms intended to protect the games and thus fall under the DMCA violation, not the emulation itself. So Nintendo always says, the act of emulating is not illegal, but the way you're doing it is. So this is key, as there was a clear divide in console generations when everyone started to encrypt game contents. This started with the PlayStation 3, the Xbox 360, the Wii, and the 3DS. So this argument is not applicable to older generations. I kept referencing Bleem versus PlayStation. Well, Sony didn't encrypt their games. No, the PS1 and the PS2 did not encrypt their games. So you did not have to have any kind of, you know, stolen keys, or you did not have to circumvent the DMCA to be able to decrypt those games. So starting with the PlayStation 3 and the Xbox 360 and the Wii and the 3DS, that all the console makers started encrypting their games. And so now you needed to circumvent the DMCA just to play those games. As a result, using Sony versus Bleem case, according to this person, is not correct for emulators targeting newer systems, as it was only concerned about running the code on another system not designed by the original manufacturer. So some people, including lawyers, argued that the keys themselves are not copyrightable. But re-implementing the cryptographic schemes for DRM and adjacent subsystems is a completely gray legal area. That's what hasn't been tested in court yet, is the key, the string, is essentially what it is. It's a string of, you know, in I don't know exactly how many characters. A lot of times it's, you know, 64 characters, 228 characters, 256 characters, some multiple of eight. And it's probably encoded in, you know, some, you know, base 64 or something else like that. Like, this is that encryption scheme is used, or what I was describing, is used in a lot of places on the web. I don't know if that's actually what they're using in consoles today, but it's something like that. Is that string of numbers and letters copyrightable? Is the question. We don't have an answer for that. This is why, continuing on what he was saying, this is why the settlement of Nintendo versus Yuzu is such a letdown in some ways, is this was the closest chance to date we had in settling what is and isn't allowed to be re-implemented as part of an emulator. Sooner or later, we will have a court case to clarify these and many other points, as it's literally impossible to implement emulators now without re-implementing the DRM mechanisms. And yes, pointing back at Nintendo and other companies that use official emulators is not correct either. I did this. As they hold the implicit copyright over their own implementations, or they license it to other companies that do retro releases that rely on original ROMs. So Nintendo can give a license to, let's say, Digital Eclipse to have an emulator that uses the keys to emulate something if they really wanted to. So some emulators, like Vit3K, try to work around at least some of the DRM burden by requiring game content encryption using external tools and not implementing it as part of the emulator itself. But then Nintendo is arguing that even mentioning the tools that do this is illegal, even when they're using the original hardware and firmware and not re-implementing or dumping the keys beforehand. So just talking about it is illegal. That could be tested in court, and probably the courts would be like, no, talking about stuff is legal. Yes, everyone outside of Nintendo's lawyers thinks it's overreaching, but legally speaking, it's neither allowed nor prohibited at the moment. So that's some of the stuff that we, you know, that I didn't, some of the context that I didn't have at the time when I was talking about the story last week. And so now we have a little bit more of the content here. So, you know, companies got smarter in how they design modern systems. They're like, okay, we can't touch the old stuff, but the new stuff, you know, now, you know, there's more things going on that that might run be illegal. So what this does mean is that the gray area here, the very end, legally speaking, this is not allowed or prohibited. That has spooked some people and strengthened some other people's resolve. There was a story in The Verge that reported that 7 developers have stepped away from projects, are shutting them down, or have left the emulation scene entirely. Of those that remain, many are circling the wagons, getting quieter and more careful, trying not to paint targets on their backs. 5 developers declined to talk to The Verge, telling them they didn't want to draw any attention. One even tried to delete answers to my questions after we'd begun, suddenly scared of attracting press. I am going to go on a side tangent here, not about this, but there was a very interesting article in a site called Aftermath which is it's a subscriber only site, so it's a subscriber only article. And Aftermath, it's like a lot of the people that used to be like Vice's Motherboard and Waypoint, and you know a lot of those you know people that did kind of more critical analysis of the industry and stuff like that. And there was a very interesting article in there where they talked to somebody who used to be legal counsel for like Nintendo and stuff. And they asked directly about fan games. And they're like, what was it? Like, when did you go after fan games and stuff? And they're like, oh, it's thanks to you, the media. Because we wouldn't know about it until Kotaku wrote an article about it. So when Kotaku writes about this great fan game, we then go look into it. And then he says, and then the second half was, if they have a Patreon or a Kickstarter or they're making money somehow with it, that's when we go after them. So the story is, if you're making a fan game, don't get press and don't make money on it. Basically, don't tell anybody you're working on it and don't make money off of it, because Nintendo doesn't know you're doing it until Kotaku writes about it, or The Verge writes about it, or Polygon writes about it, or any of the big sites write about it. So that's something that is something that I kind of knew intrinsically, like it felt true, but we actually had a lawyer come out and say, oh yeah, it's because the press writes about it. Once the press writes about it and we know about it, we don't know about it until that happens, because the scene is so, so large that they don't keep a watch over like GitHub to find these things, or you know, small like Discord servers and stuff. No, they don't learn about it until it gets mainstream attention from one of the big blog sites. So that now for journalism or game blogging or whatever you want to call game blogging, if you want to call that journalism or not, it's, do you report on something that is newsworthy and of interest to your readers, knowing that just your act of reporting on it will most likely get it taken down? The cease and desist would not come until you wrote about it. And so now you've got to think, is it worth it? It is a newsworthy story. It is something that is of interest to your readers. It is something that is impressive. So it is, you know, your journalistic duty to report on it. But by reporting on it, guarantees that it probably won't see the light of day. Questbuster says, tangentially, this also echoes a bit about Nintendo versus Atari, as Tengen, back in the late 80s, when the courts decided reverse engineering was completely fine, but how Atari went about it, lying to the copyright office to get a copy of the code to the verify carts that they were using and creating their answer, was not. And E3VL says, what's the current status on Pal World? I mean, it's still up. I don't think anybody's gone. I don't think Nintendo's gone after Pal World yet. The Breakman says, well, I've seen cable news. Anyone can call themselves a journalist these days. And Fifth Dream says, Schrodinger's fan project. I will say right now, for the record, I do not consider myself a journalist. 10 years ago, some people thought I was a journalist and treated me as such and talked about my ethics. But I do not consider myself a journalist. I consider myself more of a commentator. Of course, now it's influencer, is the term, but I consider myself more of a commentator, not a journalist. So don't think I'm a journalist. Yes, I have interviewed people, but I don't have that much journalistic integrity, which is why the one that you see often from this show on people like H Bomber Guy, we actually removed that video from our YouTube. It doesn't exist anymore. Pop culture as critic. I don't critique things like games as often. I give impressions, but I actually stopped reviewing games about 10 years ago, probably 2014, 2015. So I don't even really do critiques of games anymore. I don't consider myself a journalist, and I'm not a great interviewer in the sense of journalistic integrity, which is why I wind up in videos, long, like, three-hour expose videos of people that I've interviewed before, and I appear multiple times, and people, like, every month, somebody would be like, hey, I just saw you in a video. I took that video off YouTube. Sorry, Tommy. Anyway, let's get back to the emulators and the story from The Verge. Not every emulator developer was afraid to talk to The Verge. Five of them said no. Another one said started deleting their answers. Four other emulator teams tell Verge they're optimistic Nintendo won't challenge them, that they're on strong legal footing, and that Yuzu may have been an unusually incriminating case. One decade-long veteran tells everyone tells me everyone's just a bit more worried. But when The Verge points out that Nintendo didn't have to prove a thing in court, they all admit they don't have money for lawyers. They say they'd probably be forced to roll over like Yuzu if the Japanese game giant came knocking. One of them says, quote, "I would do what I'd have to do. I would want to fight it, but at the same time, I know we exist because we don't antagonize Nintendo," unquote. That was one of the four, the most confident one. They also say they're stripping out some parts of the Yuzu that made it easier to play pirated games. So there's a different emulator. I'm skipping around in this article. A forked version of which basically means they took the source code and imagine like the source code is like a road and then there's a fork in the road. Or you can, you know, take a side thing. So at that point of time, they took the code base at that time and went down a different road. So that's when we say forking in development context, that's what it is that there's a main road and then you fork another street off of it. And so you start from that point where they were there. And then there's, you know, and then you kind of have your own development on the side. Kind of using this in streamer terms, OBS and Streamlabs OBS. Streamlabs OBS was forked from OBS a while ago, and both things continued development independently. So things that were done in OBS after the forking point, or after the fork, didn't get in Streamlabs OBS, and then what Streamlabs OBS did not get back into OBS, and that was the whole fallout between Streamlabs and OBS. Anyway, so a forked version of Yuzu called Suyu, S-U-Y-U, because they'll sue you, will require you to bring the firmware, title.keys, and prod.keys from your Switch before you can decrypt and play Nintendo games. Only one of those was technically required before. Never mind that most people don't have an easily hackable first-gen Switch and would likely download those things off the net. The developer of another fork tells The Verge they plan to do something similar, making users fend for yourself by making sure the code doesn't auto-generate any keys. Most developers spoken with The Verge are also trying to make it clear that they are not profiting at Nintendo's expense. One who initially locked early access builds behind a donation page has stopped doing that, making them publicly available on GitHub instead. The leader of another project tells The Verge that nothing will ever be paywalled, and for now, there's strictly no donation either. When they asked about the Dolphin emulator, which faced a minor challenge from Nintendo last year, told it was publicly exposed as its tiny nonprofit budget for anyone to scrutinize. Here's what's shut down. These emulators have left the scene in the past week. The Citra emulator for the Nintendo 3DS, that was actually run by the Yuzu team, so that was part of the settlement with Nintendo. So the Citra emulator for 3DS, the Pizza Boy emulators for Nintendo Game Boy Advance and Game Boy Color are gone. The Drastic emulator for Nintendo DS is free for now and will be removed in the future. The lead developers of Yuzu and Citra stepped away from the emulation, so these are people that actually know the code base the best. They are not going to work on it anymore. The lead developer of Strato, a Switch emulator, has stepped away from emulation, so even though Strato is not part of this, they don't want to have to pay $2.4 million to Nintendo. Dynarmic, used to speed up various emulators, including Yuzu, has abruptly ended development. One contributor to Ryujinx, a Switch emulator, has stepped away from the project. And Aether SX2, a PlayStation 2 emulator, is finally gone. Although this is mostly unrelated, development was suspended a year ago, probably with the Dolphin stuff going on. And Zemuck11 says, I have Pizza Boy. I need to check my app. It's not going to be deleted from... Hopefully they wouldn't. You would still have it. They're just not going to ever update it again. So what you have... If something doesn't work, it's never going to work. A lot of stuff's going on in the emulator side, but kind of reading kind of what our Discord friend had said, who works on an emulator that's not listed in any of these, and, you know, kind of learning more about what happened here, it's really about doing emulation for consoles that exist today. For the longest time, you couldn't emulate today's stuff. Now they're able to emulate the Switch and actually have the games run better on emulation than they do on the Switch itself. That's where things are getting kind of hairy, and we're getting into this piracy thing, because in the past, they were always emulating consoles two or three generations behind. And, you know, while I'm sure the company, you know, the publishers didn't like that, they didn't, because it did facilitate a little bit of piracy, let's be honest, it was still old stuff. Now that we're emulating a console that is currently actively being sold, with games being actively put out, and Yuzu's big thing, their big failing, what cost them the $2.4 million is that they facilitated a game that hadn't even come out yet to be played on their emulator. And I'm sure that what they would have found, the discovery phase through Discord logs and email logs and things, probably would have cost them a lot more than $2.4 million, and probably would have cost jail time, which is probably why they settled. Like, you never know. They might have passed around Tears of the Kingdom in their emails, in their Discord or something, and that would all come out in discovery, and that's like active piracy right there, and that's jail time in the U.S., if they are U.S.-based. So, you know, having the LLC have to liquidate all its assets and pay to Nintendo, because Nintendo's not getting $2.4 million out of this. They don't have $2.4 million. But, you know, it's a lot better than jail time. Yeah, it's kind of a hairy situation, unfortunately. I do not blame any emulator developer for stepping away. It is a volunteer thing, after all. And at some point, it's not worth it. Hobbies, like, essentially at this point, it's a hobby. It's a hobby that we all love. It's game preservation, which should be actually something that people are paid to do. Unfortunately, they're not, so you have to do it as a hobby. I will tell you this right now. If it suddenly became, like, if I was risking jail time doing this stream and this podcast, considering it's a hobby, I'm walking away. I'll tell you that right now. I don't need that hobby as much in my life. That if I'm going to get jailed for doing my hobby, yeah, I'm walking away. I'm absolutely walking away. As Jerry Matt says, if there was any litigation, they would have to give out their Discord group info, which is a slippery slope. Yeah, that's there's probably a lot of stuff they would have found in that Discord server that they did not want showing up in discovery. So this avoids all that. It also avoids implicating other people that were in the Discord server that maybe weren't named in the initial lawsuit. Well, now it's going to be part of the, it would have been part of the public record that they were breaking the law and they could be jailed. This honestly is, this honestly is protecting a lot of people that we don't know what Yuzu did. So I know you can sit there and say that they were cowards for not taking Nintendo to court and having it in a court of law. But I honestly think there was probably such damning evidence that would have hurt so many other people that were not specifically involved with the Yuzu emulation development and the company that I think this probably is the right call in the end. DJ Rama S says, what's sad is that people I know like to pirate because they can, aren't talking about the fundraising of these emulators and still blaming Nintendo for taking what they think is rightfully theirs. The Breakman says, to put so much passion into something you are doing because you love it, only to have someone tell you to stop, even though they aren't hurting anyone. And in the court of law, names would have to be revealed. Judges are not going to deal with usernames. Yes, like they would, as part of this process, the court would basically, subpoena Discord to give the data on these users. And Questbush says, one of the first things I was told by lawyers when called jury duty is that most cases never make it to trial because they settle. Yes. A lot of times, like, if you're in jury duty, for the most part, they will settle just to not have to face the jury a lot of times. Not every time. But they will be like, okay, we're assembling the jury now. Are you sure you want to go through this? This jury might not rule in your favor. Are you sure this is what could happen if a jury rules against you? Here's what we're offering. It's not as bad as what the jury could do. And then they settle. And frankly, like, I am all for game preservation. I'm not a fan of pirating things that are currently actively being sold. Even if you hate the publisher, and you're like, I know the developers aren't getting royalties and I'm not screwing over the developers, I'm screwing over the publisher, I'm not a fan of that. But if there's no other way to get it, I've started coming around to, yeah, it's okay. But I would love to see more companies make it more easy to play a lot of these old things and have something legal about it, like our friends at Digital Eclipse. I don't say our friends because I've never talked to them. They're not a friend of the show because they haven't come on yet. But let's kind of switch gears and talk about something that was emulated legally. And let's talk about Digital Eclipse, and let's talk about the Gold Master series. That's Jay Winnemann says, what a segue. Yes, I thought of that on the fly there. So this week, what is rapidly becoming my favorite game series, or favorite series of interactive products to come out on game consoles, LlamaSoft, The Jeff Minter Story came out. This is the Gold Master series from Digital Eclipse. This is the second entry into the Gold Master series. The first was The Making of Karateka. But I also consider Atari 50 to really be the genesis of the Gold Master series because it is also the same. Dark Tatsuya says, I thought about getting this one, but I'm not too familiar with this work. Here's the thing. If you're in America, you most likely aren't. Because Jeff Minter is a very, very British developer who only sold his games in the UK except for two, and they changed the name of the second one to something different. It's great. Breakman says Digital Eclipse, a name I don't hear often. So Digital Eclipse, they were basically a house that basically specialized in restoring and remastering old properties in emulation and things like that. When you saw Digital Eclipse did the emulation for like an HD up remake or a remaster, really, you knew there was going to be some good stuff. And actually, Digital Eclipse was recently bought by Atari. So Digital Eclipse is now a part of Atari. So that's who Digital Eclipse is. They did a lot of the retro collections and stuff. And now they've really taken up the mantle of, we are going to tell the story of retro game development. And we are going to call it the Gold Master series. They did The Making of Karateka, and now they've done LlamaSoft, The Jeff Minter Story. Jeff Minter was he looked like a hippie. The traditional story that you hear of dropped out of college because he got a Commodore computer in 1981 and said, I'm going to try to write stuff on it and I'm going to make stuff. And then, oh, I can sell these. And then, you know, he became Jeff Minter, essentially. And the Brickman says, so you mean the new Atari? Yes, the current iteration of Atari, which bought Moby Games, which is like the IMDb for video games, the Atari Age Forum, which is all about like homebrew stuff, and then Digital Eclipse. The current Atari is really about, let's celebrate when the original Atari and that era of games. LlamaSoft, The Jeff Minter Story came out this week, and it's filled with games that I had never heard of or played, because he was very big in the Commodore scene and then later on like the Atari ST scene. Most of Americans probably didn't know who Jeff Minter was until Tempest 2000, which was the only good game on the Atari Jaguar. It's why you had an Atari Jaguar. Funny enough, Atari itself, at that Atari, didn't like it. And this is all on the Wikipedia. This wasn't actually in this collection. But like they didn't like it, so they actually made a version of it for the PlayStation, but had a programmer change it just enough that they didn't have to pay royalties to Jeff Minter, because they didn't like it, but it sold. It was the best seller. So Atari had to do something with it, and they, you know, I guess they didn't like Jeff. I don't know. But Tempest 2000 was like 15 years into his career. And actually, that's where this collection ends. So what Digital Eclipse does is that it's like a museum and a documentary. So it's got, they basically have like pictures that he's provided, and you go through and there's a timeline, and it's like, you started with this, and here's what the cassette art looked like, you know, when you bought it on cassette, because he released all his games on cassette in the early 80s. There was no discs anywhere. It was all cassette based. And then you can actually play the game. And they've got games from, you know, like the ZX80 and the ZX81, the Spectrum and things like that. And, you know, stuff like he wrote this in BASIC and sold it. And it's, you know, not that great. But and a lot of these games aren't great. Like, there are a lot of the stuff that he did early on, but it kind of tells the story of who Jeff Minter is, why he was doing what he was doing. Talks about how he really loves llamas and other farm animals like sheep and stuff, so that's why it's LlamaSoft. Talks about, like, the first company that he was in, and there's video interviews in here of, like, him, because he's still alive, and he's still actually making games. You know, talking to, like, other journalists in the day, and it even talks about his spat with a local game publishing magazine, Zap, who later on, they didn't like one of his games. And he didn't like the fact that they didn't like one of his games, and they kind of had a fight for a bit. And they actually had the journalist who didn't write his game on the video talking about why he didn't like it. So it really chronicles through that, and you can actually see that Jeff Minter was amazing with the Commodore VIC-20. He made games for the Commodore 64, which is probably where, if you did know Jeff Minter before Tempest 2000, you probably know him from the Commodore 64 games. But his VIC-20 skills were amazing. He made really fast, really quick arcade-like games. Grid Runner being the one a lot of people know. And he made it on the Commodore 64. But the VIC-20 is the one that actually plays faster. The Commodore 64, it's a little slower, a little sluggish. It's got better graphics, better sound, but it's not as frenetic and fast pace as the VIC-20 version. In fact, on the C64, which is the like the C64 Mini, and I've got the what we call the Maxi, but the full-size one, they actually include the VIC-20 version of Grid Runners on it, not the Commodore 64 version, because the VIC-20 version, a lot of people consider to be a lot faster, a lot better. And he made the VIC-20 sing. But it goes through kind of like how he started off, and he actually made a port of Centipede. Here's the funny thing. He made a port of Centipede, the arcade game, having never played it. He saw screenshots. And so he made an arcade game and sold it as Centipede, claiming it was like the arcade game. So his version of Centipede, you can't go up and down, because he didn't realize you could go up and down. And the Centipedes fired lasers, shot back at you. And so he made a version of Centipede for, like, the ZX80. So it's black and white and stuff like that. Grid Runner basically became he took that concept and it became Grid Runner, which is kind of the big game that everybody knew from him. But yeah, so he made a version of Centipede without ever having played Centipede, only seeing screenshots of it. It's great. But you go through and it shows, like, here's the art, here's the instruction manuals. You needed, like, 10-page instruction manuals to understand his games, even though, you know, it's just a joystick and a fire button, because you got to understand what's going on. It does go into his things like he was also very much into music visualizers, which was, you know, something that we kind of take for granted now because everything has them nowadays, where it's like got swirling lights and stuff to music. But he was really, you know, he was probably high. They didn't mention that in the show or not, if he was high. But he was like, what if I could have the computer play back light patterns? And I could program it to do it based on this music that I'm playing elsewhere. So the computer wasn't playing the music. The idea was you would put on the vinyl or the cassette or whatever. And then you would basically record on the computer what you wanted the screen to look like. And then you could play it back. And so that's how he did that. And he did a bunch of these visualizers all throughout. Like, he still does them today. Apparently there was a visualizer embedded in the Xbox 360 firmware. He did that. So he did a lot of those, and a couple of them are in, this, and they actually use, like, you can hit the bumpers to, like, have it play music for you. And then, you know, that's how you would do things with the keyboard and things like that. So, as Jared Matt says, if you're a game designer in the 70s and 80s, you were on something. Fair point. So it went into some of that. It went into the games. It actually has like complexity ratings for the games. There is a lot of strobe effects. Some games you can turn off the strobe effects. Some games you can't. So that's something to know if you do happen to have, are prone to, you know, having epileptic seizures or just not liking flashing lights. Know that. And then what they have, the one game. So, A, this only goes up to 1994, which is basically the first 15 years of his career. It does not touch the 25 years since. He's still making games. He's actually made games for VR. Like, he's got PlayStation VR games. He's got Oculus Rift games. He was one of the early people that did stuff on the Oculus Rift. He's still making games today. LlamaSoft is still making games today. But this really, like, it stops at basically Tempest 2000. And then there's two videos after that was like, oh, and here's what he did later and stuff like that. So it's really like the early years. And there's like 40 games. One of them's for a failed system that never came out. It's the first time anybody's played like the Konix multi-game system where you had Attack of the Mutant Camels, which was Empire Strikes Back, but with camels instead of AT-ATs. So there's that. And then the remastered game was really interesting that they made for this. So they remastered Grid Runner, which is essentially it's Centipede on a grid with other things going on and everything. So it's not Centipede anymore. They're aliens. But what they did was actually kind of ingenious. They had this Commodore 64 code, which I don't know if they got the source code or if they just decompiled the assembler. I mean, there's multiple ways they could have gotten it. So it's running the Commodore 64 code, and then they put a modern Jeff Minter visualizer for the game on top of it. So you're playing Grid Runner, but it looks like a modern Jeff Minter game, which is like, when I say modern games, I'm thinking, you know, like Tempest 2000, but also Space Giraffe was on the Xbox 360. That was a game from him. He's got some Minotaur games or something that's come out on like PlayStation 4 and things like that. There's a very distinct style to a Jeff Minter game in the 21st century. It makes Grid Runner do that, but it's the Commodore 64 game at heart, like literally the exact same code. So all the same logic, all the same game loop, all the same everything. They just interpret the graphics calls and sound calls differently. So much so that you can actually hit the right bumper and it, you know, does a little flourish, animation flourish, and immediately you're in the Commodore 64 version of the game. And then you can hit it again, and it'll immediately, while you're playing, go back. It's like go back to the main version of the game. And also, if you're playing in like the remastered version, you hit the pause screen. The pause screen is actually the Commodore 64 version frozen in time. I thought that was actually kind of neat, how they basically, they're like, no, we didn't rebuild the game. We just put a better visualizer on it. And Pop Culture says, like the Halo remasters. Yeah, like it's probably like that. It gives you the same effect as that. And I believe there's some other games that do that where you can, you know, flip between the original 8-bit and there's some other remasters that do that, like side-scroller ones, where you can flip between the old and the new seamlessly. This does that because it's literally running the Commodore 64 version of the game. They just are interpreting some other things. And Dark Tetsuya says they did that on Wizardry on PC. Also, they use the visualizer code that he made for the menu, for the backgrounds. And they actually tell you, like, halfway through, they're like, yeah, you've actually been watching this visualizer this entire time. It's what's running in the background, like, on Chapter 3. So, they did a really good job with a lot of this. Now, not everything is perfect in it. On the Nintendo Switch version, which I got, there was some audio desync issues. That's been patched. So, like, when you watch the movies, it was desynced like about a second. So the audio was like 1 second later than the video. So it was really weird watching people's lips move. And also the thing about those videos is that there actually is a documentary being filmed by somebody else. So Digital Eclipse didn't really film that documentary. They just used a lot of the interviews from it. And there's a teaser for that documentary that somebody is doing about Jeff Minter at the end, so when that documentary is done, and it's more about the visualizers, actually, like that documentary. So it might delve into more things after 1994. But it's a good introduction. It's the first 15 years of Jeff Minter's career. There is one game that doesn't play well. Actually, there's a lot of games that don't play well because they're very esoteric. You go in there and I'm like, I can't figure out what's going on. There's so many flashing lights. There's a 10-page manual I could read, or I could be like, okay, that's cool, next game. But Battleix is a game that's from the Commodore 64. And unfortunately, hardcore people who are big Llama Softies, which is the name of the Llama Soft fans, they actually do talk about that in the thing. Battleix, it's the idea of it is that there's actually a collection of minigames. There are 6 minigames in all. You can flick to one of the other minigames by hitting keys 1 through 6 on the Commodore 64. As time runs down, the difficulty increases. So game number 6 is a light synth mode. It's a visualizer. It's a pause mode. In the version that's in the Digital Eclipse release, the left switch sticks switches between the games before you start. But once you start, you cannot switch to another game on the fly. You have to back out to the menu screen, which resets the timer. On the PC version, the keys are disabled, so you cannot use 1 through 6 on the keyboard to switch games on the fly. So in order to get a high score in Battleix, you actually need to be flipping games as the timer progresses so you get more points. And you can't do that on the Digital Eclipse version. And there's probably, like, they were probably like, yeah, people that made the Digital Eclipse version probably didn't think that through. Because probably most people went back to the main menu to select another game, when really the idea is you're switching the games on the fly and you're going to a different game as the timer goes up. There was also another thing that was very interesting that that I noticed is that it very, like, Jeff Minter doesn't keep this a secret because there are articles about this, but at the very end, it introduces, it says LlamaSoft is actually 2 people. He's got another developer, Ivan Zorzin. And it talks about how Ivan, is helping doing a lot of the development on the modern consoles. That way, like, Jeff can concentrate on what he's best at. And Ivan works on, like, actually making it work on a Nintendo Switch or on an Xbox or on a PlayStation or on an Oculus Rift. And it kind of leaves it at that. So you come across, like, okay, so LlamaSoft is 2 people. You hired this other person and, you know, they met. And stuff. But if you actually, like, know anything about it and read other interviews, it's also his domestic partner. So they're not just professional partners, and they just kind of leave that to the side. Like, they don't even mention it. I guess they didn't want any blowback from making that a big part of it. That Jeff and Ivan are also a couple. Although, if you go on gamedeveloper.com, there's an interview this week with Jeff Minter, and it talks about their relationship and how it survived this long, both professionally and domestically. So I thought it was kind of interesting that they kind of omitted that, and I'm sure that it was just so they didn't have to deal with any blowback from somebody who probably wouldn't be good with that. But Jeff doesn't keep it a secret, really. But it introduces him right at the end because Ivan didn't show up until after 1994 when essentially this collection ends. So I do recommend it. It was a day one purchase for me. I got it on the Switch. It is, I think, $30. You get 40 games out of it. Grid Runner's fun. Attack of the Mutant Camels, once you get it, is kind of fun. But it is a little overwhelming on the senses. There is a lot of complexity to these games that probably didn't need to be there. And even Jeff Minter would say there's some complexities there that probably didn't need to be there. The version of Tempest 2000 that's in it is exactly the same as the one in Atari 50, including with the overclocking and the 60 frames per second that they added in a patch. So I think it's really worth it. And also, like, I didn't know much about Jeff Minter. So I can appreciate Jeff Minter a little more now because I know more about him. The only time I had played his games before Tempest 2000 was on the C64 because it's got Grid Runner. It's got Hover Bover, which is basically a lawn cutting game. And then there's, like, a dog. And basically in Hover Bover or Bover or whatever, you steal your neighbor's lawnmower to mow your lawn and the neighbor comes out wanting it back, but you have a dog and you can stick your dog on the neighbor to stop him, and you're trying to mow your lawn, trying to avoid your neighbor. I first played it on the C64. It was kind of interesting, but that's a Jeff Minter game. It is not one of the finalists for the Hall of Fame. That's right. There's a World Video Game Hall of Fame. The Museum of Play at museumofplay.org has a World Video Game Hall of Fame. And every year they induct some new franchises and games. And they are currently taking the public voting right now. So the World Video Game Hall of Fame received thousands of nominations for consideration for the 2024 class. Fans can vote for their favorite finalists from March 14th through 21st as part of Player's Choice Ballot at worldvideogamehalloffame.org. The three games that receive the most public votes will form one ballot and will join the other ballots submitted by members of the International Selection Advisory Committee, which is made up of journalists and scholars familiar with the history of video games and their role in society. The public collectively will have the weight of one judge. The final inductees will be announced on an on-site ceremony in the World Video Game Hall of Fame's new home, part of the ESL Digital Worlds exhibits at The Strong on Thursday, May 9th at 10:30 a.m. So, the games that are nominated, the 12 finalists for induction, which is, and essentially they induct franchises as well, so you'll hear a game name and be like, well, which one? All of them. Asteroids, Elite, Guitar Hero, Metroid, Myst, Neopets, Resident Evil, SimCity, Tokimeki Memorial, Tony Hawk's Pro Skater, Ultima, and You Don't Know Jack. So those are the 12 games you can select. Basically all the public's votes will be make one ballot. And there's, I don't know how many other ballots there are on there. So it's just you're one judge out of a bunch. We are collectively that. You can vote every day, once a day, for what you like. I voted for Ultima because I did. The Breakman says, screw Myst. That's your opinion. SJ Matt says, I have to go to this Hall of Fame. I'm only like an hour and a half away. I'd go to this one. The Breakman says, Metroid for sure. Need to think about the next. SJ Matt says, I put in a vote for You Don't Know Jack. I mean, I'm all for that vote too. Elite is a big one. That was one of the first big space sims. That's where Elite Dangerous is, you know, the next version of Elite. I mean, Guitar Hero is very close to my heart, thanks to, you know, it, but I was Rock Band. DJ Ram S says Tokimeki Memorial. That was the one that probably a lot of people that probably a lot of Americans don't know, which is why it probably won't be on the public's ballot. It won't make it to the top three of the public's ballot, but that's why they have a whole bunch of other scholars and stuff. Questbrush says, surprised some of these aren't already in the museum already, like the first three Ultima titles. I think they only induct three per year. They're trying to make it very exclusive. And I think this is the Ultima series. So, like, if Ultima gets in, Ultima 1 through 9 is now in. Like, it's the series, just like Metroid and stuff like that. It's the Metroid series or the Resident Evil series or the Guitar Hero series because... I think that's where they're kind of going with it instead of trying to induct individual games, especially when there's so many of them. And so which port do you put in? Like the Guitar Hero that they show is the Guitar Hero for Wii. It's the box for the Wii version is the one that they show. Questbuster says, fun fact, Ultima was big enough to force SSI, Strategic Simulations Inc., I think, to license the design from Richard Garriott for Questron, when it seemed too similar. Breakman says, we wouldn't have Metroidvanias without Metroid, and Castlevania blatantly copying them, but that's another story. So you can go over to, World Video Game Hall of Fame.org and vote for your favorite, and you can vote once per day for one, and the top three vote-getters will go on the ballot for the public. So I talked a lot about emulation and Jeff Minter, so I will not be doing a music break this week. Coming up next here on the Voice of Geeks Network at twitch.tv/VogNetwork is Orange Lounge Radio. It's three people out in Sacramento, California. They talk about games for much, much longer than I do, and we like to check in with them and see what's going on over there. Sacramento, are you there?
Hi, I'm here, Bobby. How are you?
I am doing well. So did you ever play Jeff Minter games when you were in your big Commodore 64 games as a kid, or was that more...
I feel like I've played Grid Runner at some point. I really do, because that game looked very familiar to me, to be honest. So, and you know, my dad, through his work, got lots of copies of games from all over. I mean, that's just the way it was.
Yes.
Like, you know, it was one of those things I'm not proud of in retrospect, but it's just the way it was back then. So, I'm pretty sure Grid Runner was one of those games.
I mean, I have a TikTok that I put up while you can still access TikTok in America. I have a TikTok where I was like, you know, the making of Karateka, it was great, blah, blah, blah. And here's my disc of Karateka that my dad copied from the software store instead of buying it. And here it is, you know, handwritten label. Mm-hmm. You know, it was rampant.
It's rampant.
But also, like, it's kind of interesting because part of this, what they do in LavaSoft is Jeff Minter had a zine. He had a fanzine, like you could, and so he would write his thoughts, and he had like 10 of these. And in one of them, he talks about piracy, and he's like, you know, we shouldn't be, you know, trying to do all these things like technologically to do it, because like we shouldn't be worried if like some kid copies a tape, because all his games were on cassette. He's like, we really shouldn't be worried about that. I'm worried about the, you know, publisher stealing it and trying to sell it. That's what I'm worried about. I'm not worried about kids copying tape, because I copied music and then I went and bought the next album from them because I liked them. And he's like, I don't mind if, you know, somebody copies Grid Runner, because then they might, you know, buy Mutant Camels, Revenge of the Mutant Camels or something. And
yeah,
so
the publishers don't like that line of thinking.
Yeah. Well, and that's why he actually talks about, like, and it's kind of interesting because he has his thoughts about like the bigger publishers, and he's like, you know, because the distributors were crowding him out because he didn't have the ad budget and stuff like that. And he's like, but I make good games. Do you want sterile stuff like Activision and this, you know? So it was kind of interesting to kind of see it, like you could read through his thoughts in the 80s about piracy and about the publishing and where the video game industry was going.
Yeah, and we still bought lots of games. I mean, it's just that we had lots more that we didn't. And that's kind of just how it was back then.
Yeah, and I think what it said is that in the U.S., they only released his stuff on cartridge in the U.S.
So
they were released on cassette in the U.K., but then they put it on a cartridge in the U.S. And then that company went under. And so he lost that whole, like, and so he lost all the, any recurring revenue from that. And also, I think what they said is that the Grid Runners 2, they renamed to be Revenge of the Mutant Camels, which was already a game he had made, but they liked the name. They didn't like that game. So they took Grid Runners 2, called it Revenge of the Mutant Camels in the U.S.
Yeah. Funny how that works before there was really that global awareness of, you know, what a game, you know, look at Final Fantasy numbering or, you know, Dragon Quest, Dragon Warrior, you know, those sorts of things have been around for a very long time. So,
but it does go into like he was very early on the shareware stuff for like the Atari ST computers. So he actually released some shareware titles back in the, you know, days of Apogee and Epic Mega Games and id Software doing their shareware stuff. So he did it. Which actually saved the company. And his shareware was, like, if you like this, send me £5. Because he's British, so it was £5. It wasn't like, oh, here's episode one, you can get the other episodes. It's like, here it is, the whole thing. If you like it, send me £5. And people did. Yeah. And it worked. So it's an interesting thing. I know you like these Gold Master series, and I do,
and I haven't picked this one up yet. So I was really interested in your kind of analysis. Yeah. Like I will pick it up at some point. I just, you know, I was very hyper focused on No Man's Sky this particular week. But I will definitely pick that up. So I was a big fan of what they do with Karateka. So and I'm looking forward to see what they do next.
And it's not as long as Karateka.
Really? Because I didn't feel like Karateka was that long, all things considered. But seems like there's definitely more games to kind of absorb with this. Yeah. So I guess maybe that's the trade-off.
Because there's not that much other, like, ancillary information, and all the interviews are part of, like, a two-hour movie that's going to be coming out. So there's, you know, so it there's only four chapters instead of the five that was in Karateka, and it felt like this was quicker to go through.
Now, were there any random cameos? Because remember, I was trying to read the crystal ball on what the second game might be, and I was like, oh, well, why did they have the Mortal Kombat guy? Oh, no random cameos.
Well, see, Digital Eclipse didn't film the interviews.
I figured they could have had a mix and match or something.
No, yeah. they because a lot of these interviews were filmed in like 2018, 2019. It's this guy, there's a guy, and I can't remember his name, but he's in the documentary at the very end. The last video is basically him talking about his documentary and why he's doing all of these interviews and what he wants to show in his documentary. Mm-hmm. But all of the interviews are actually from his documentary work.
Hmm.
So Digital Eclipse did not film anything.
Interesting. So then there's still hope on my cameo crystal ball prediction for the third game, potentially. We'll see. Yeah. We'll see.
So, no, most of the people that were in this, there were no other game developers, really. There was one influencer. There's like two women in the whole thing. And one's an influencer and one's somebody who actually did some art for him later. And then there's like, they talked to the journalists that actually covered him in the 80s from that British magazine. They talked to them. And then it's like they've got like a super fan and stuff. There's not that many people that were interviewed in it. So it's not the bevy of interviews like Karateka, because like I said, they just licensed this documentary footage from a documentary that's not complete yet.
Interesting. Well, that probably helps the documentary get finished too.
Yeah.
With that, you know, little income source. So neat.
Yep.
I'll have to check it out. I'll definitely do that at this point, some point this week.
Yep. So what's your Hall of Fame pick? Well, if you had to pick one today and you could pick another one tomorrow and whatever, out of the games that are in the Hall of Fame, if you need me to read them to you again,
you have to read it to me again because I didn't catch it all.
All right. So, here's what's nominated for the Hall of Fame. Asteroids, Elite, Guitar Hero, Metroid, Myst, Neopets, Resident Evil, SimCity, Tokimeki Memorial, Tony Hawk's Pro Skater, Ultima, and You Don't Know Jack.
Ooh, I get to pick three or I only have to pick one?
Well, so the way they do it, like, so let's say you were doing a ballot, you could pick three. Because the people, if we were actually picking ballots, we would get three picks.
I would pick SimCity. That's where my heart is at. I've just the hours upon hours I've put into that game. And I think the entire Sim franchise that really defined the 90s and really beyond that brought us the Sims. I think SimCity really encapsulates that. I have to go with Ultima and just everything that that's done for RPGs of made over here or, you know, the UK, as it will be, but basically outside of Japan. That's so hard. I because honestly, I really see a case for Myst and I see a case for Metroid.
No, Metroid's the wrong answer.
No, I'm gonna go with Metroid. Tough. And the reason why is because they're still remaking Myst, so it is not gone to its full potential. So I would say, you know, Metroid, we joke about Metroidvania, but really, you know, that is an entire genre of games that came of that. But honestly, like, again, like, I'm not saying that any of these are bad, because I you could really make a case for something like You Don't Know Jack and how that leads to the Jackbox Party Pack, which was essential for what we have, you know, in the COVID era. Obviously Asteroids, an all-time classic. Like, there's a lot of game, they're on this list for a reason. So this is really Sophie's choice in a way, but if you're gonna ask where my gut goes, those are the three.
Yeah, see, I was going SimCity, Ultima, and then I was kind of looking at, like, Mr. You Don't Know Jack, actually.
Yeah,
that's
kind of
where I was going.
But not
Metroid. Chrono Trigger has not yet been nominated.
Too bad. Too bad.
And, I mean, Guitar Hero had a huge influence. I just don't think it's ready yet, because, unfortunately, well, I mean, now with, like, let's see how Fortnite Festival does. Because Guitar Hero, that whole genre kind of came and went. Whereas a lot of these others stuck around.
And maybe this is just my weird perspective from doing OLR for all these years. I understand why it's Guitar Hero completely, 100%. Yeah. It's weird to me that would go before Beatmania. And that's That's my word, and I'm sticking to it.
Yeah, because, like, I mean, Tokimeki Memorial is on here, so it's not that they're shying away from things that are more overtly Japanese than American.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, but I think it's also, like, who's nominating these? Americans.
Yeah. Yeah.
Even though it is the World Video Game Hall of Fame, I bet there's a lot of Western influence.
Yeah, and I'm with Questbuster in chat saying it feels like you can't really go wrong with most of these, leaving it to your heart to decide. Yeah. That's really, I think that's really what it comes down to.
There's nothing on this list that I'm going, why?
Yeah, no, there's nothing on the list where I'm like, oh, why is that nominated? No.
And I think in previous years we've said that. I want to say in previous years we've been like, why is that nominated?
Mm-hmm.
But I can't remember what they are, so it must have been too egregious. But it was like... But I mean, but this one, it's like, I could see all of them.
Yeah.
You know, because like Neopets, that was huge.
That was huge. Yeah.
So
it's one of those things where it's like the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. They'll all get inducted eventually.
Yeah.
There's somebody that keeps getting the shaft like every single year.
Jeff Minter.
I can't remember. No, not for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Oh, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. But, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you never know. Somebody... I mean, he did a lot of psychedelic music visuals. Maybe
true.
Jeff Minter will make it in before whoever you're thinking of.
Anything's possible. Anything's possible.
So what else are we going to be talking about on Orange Lounge Radio tonight?
Let's see. I'm trying to think of things that you didn't bring up. Ooh, speaking of like retro games, I think this is really cool is that Atari has a recent line of games and they are looking to potentially bring it to arcades. So things coming very full circle there, which I think is really cool. I think we'll also talk about a recent PlayStation 5 firmware upgrade that has brought some fun new features as well. And the quadruple A initiative in gaming, thanks to Ubisoft, now has met its match, the triple I initiative. We'll talk a little bit about that. Mm-hmm. Coming up on OLR.
All right. Orange Lounge Radio is up next. Thanks so much, Rob.
Thanks as always, Bobby.
So that is it for me. I will be back next Sunday night, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, right here at the Voice Geeks Network Twitch channel, twitch.tv/VogNetwork. Come join us. Interact with the show directly. I will not be here in 2 weeks. I'm going to go see a band named Dirty Loops. They're out of Sweden. They do kind of like funk jazz. Electro, like it's great. They're great musicians, and I'm kicking myself for not seeing them the last time they were in the United States, like 10 years ago or 9 years ago or something like that. So not making the same mistake twice. Unfortunately, it's on Sunday night at 8 on the 31st. So next week I will see you. In 2 weeks, I will not. I am on social media at Bobby Blackwolf just about everywhere. BobbyBlackwolf.com over on Blue Sky. I post more on Blue Sky than most of the other places. And you can also submit feedback over on our Discord server, vognetwork.com/discord. If you like the show, tell a friend. If you hate the show, tell an enemy. I don't care. Just tell someone. The show is not for everybody, but it would not be possible without the people who go above and beyond. You know, if you like, tell someone. The show's not for everybody, maybe for somebody who doesn't know about it yet. But I want to thank the people who go above and beyond, especially because I just filed our taxes, and that costs money for our LLC. Because taxes were due on the 15th for businesses, not for individuals, for businesses. So thank you so much, Fifth Dream, for your subversary resubscription. And Mike Deft, thank you so much for your 63rd week. That must be how much we've been around. Twitch math is weird. They've both been subscribed for the same amount of time, but one says 55, one says 63. They've been here for way longer than that. Thank you so much for that. You being here is really all that we ask. That's really the best, because your time is way more valuable to us, and thank you for spending your time with us, which is why I was staying home from the soccer game tonight. Instead, I was here because this is more valuable. All right. I'll see you next week. Bye.
A winner is you. The views and opinions expressed are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and are not necessarily the opinions of
the VOG Network, people who need to hire new voiceover guys,
or your mom. Although if Bobby said it, it really should be. This has been a production of Bobby Blackwolf Studios.